We're going to spend a chunk of our time in Ephesians chapter 5. So if you have a Bible, I'd love for you to turn there. And we're going to be really starting in verse 22 and reading to the end of the chapter here in a little bit. But I want to kind of set up Ephesians because I think there's a thing that I saw in kind of the layout of the Ten Commandments with the fifth commandment falling where it does. And as you think about that whole kind of sweeping outline of what Ephesians says and where this particular chunk of Ephesians lay, that there's actually a really significant thing that I want us to see before we start talking about the details of what Paul lays out in these verses. In Ephesians 1 and 2 and into the first half of 3 particularly, you have some of the most sweeping, beautiful, high places in Scripture that you'll find anywhere. As Paul kind of outlines for his people, for this church, like the glory of God's grace, his sovereign grace that was predestined before the foundations of the world, this grace that leads to our adoption, this grace that leads to God showering his mercy upon his people for ages upon ages upon ages. The stuff of Ephesians 1 is stuff that you could literally meditate on the rest of your lives. There's very few places in Scripture that I find more compelling, more beautiful, more stunning in terms of its sweeping kind of descriptions of the glory of God's grace, his mercy, his kindness to us, and how those begin before any of us were formed in our parents' wombs, before even one moment of history took place, that God intended for us this grace. It's amazing. And you get into Ephesians chapter 2, and you have this description of how that grace that he described in chapter 1 kind of takes root in our own lives in really personal ways, that this grace actually takes us as individuals from being dead and then makes us alive, and then doesn't just make us alive to God, but actually makes us alive that we might do good works. And so he goes kind of from this global, universal, sweeping description of the mercy and grace of God to a really narrow view of, okay, what does that grace actually mean in our lives as God raises us from the dead? And then kind of from that point forward, he goes in to describe the nature of those good works that he intended for us. And you get into chapter 3 and how those good works play out, and he goes back to kind of this global theme that those good works, the works that God's given us to do, the result will be that all the nations of the earth will know, declare, worship, Jesus will see and behold the infinite measure of his riches, of his grace that's been poured out. He talks about every nation under the earth bowing at the feet of Jesus. The stuff of chapter 3, it describes the scope of history and the purposes of God in history are frankly amazing. You get into chapter 4, and what he begins to describe in chapter 4 and moving into chapter 5, and particularly moving into the text we have, is how do those things actually take place? How is it that God's actually going to call all the nations of the earth? Imagine that with me for a moment. That China and all the nations and tribes represented by the nation state China, imagine with me for a moment all of them bowing at the feet of Jesus, being discipled into obedience to Jesus, loving and beholding the glory and the majesty of the grace of God given to us in Jesus. Can you imagine that? Probably not. Imagine America. Imagine Canada, of all places. Whatever you want to imagine. Imagine every single nation, every tribe, every language, every tongue, every people group on the planet beholding and worshiping Jesus in the light of the grace of God given to us. And then the immediate question that arises once you get to chapter 4 and chapter 5 is, how does that actually happen? How does Denver, Colorado become a city marked most deeply, not by mountains and recreation, not marked most deeply by the presence of marijuana or really good beer? How does it become most deeply marked by allegiance to and love for Jesus? How do we get there? And the first thing I'll throw out is that is God's intention. That's what God's doing. That's like a sermon series. But that's what God is up to. That's what God is slowly bringing about in history. And so then the next question, and frankly why we're in this room tonight, is how does God actually cause that to take place? So if I were writing chapters 4, 5, and 6, I would give a detailed plan for church planting, the establishment of schools, different denominations, missions, international missions, all kinds of big, grand, sweeping strategies about how God's going to transform Denver and transform China and transform Afghanistan and transform the United States. That the way that's going to happen is this grand, sweeping, global, let's send out martyrs, let's go transform the world that way. It's the exact opposite of the place where Paul actually goes. See, what God actually says, the way he seems to unfold his purposes and his plans for seeing the world transformed and redeemed, is people who will love one another. It is a community of people that will lay down their lives for one another's good. And then more specifically, as we get into chapter 5, chapter 4 and 5 are largely about the local church. As you get into the middle of chapter 5, he begins to outline particular kinds of relationships and how those are to play out in the midst of a city like Denver. And you get to 5:22 to the end of the chapter, and he's talking specifically about the relationships between husbands and wives. So here's the thing that's stunning to me. I love to think about God's global purposes. I love to think about, dream about, imagine together, what is God doing in the city of Denver, and how do we kind of, over the course of our lifetimes, move slowly towards that kind of realized vision that I think is going to take thousands of years to get there. What Paul essentially says is, build marriages that look like this. That's his strategy. There's a number of other things, but at the foundation of it, and you can actually go all the way back to Genesis and say, hey, what was God's plan to see the earth filled with his image and his beauty? Well, he takes a man and he takes a woman, and he introduces the whole concept of sex to them, which is a wonderful concept. And he joins them together in a covenant marriage, and he calls them to be obedient to him, particularly in the context of the relationship of a husband and wife. So we're not talking about business yet. We're not talking about entrepreneurship. We're not talking about your jobs, although Paul's going to get into that stuff in chapter 6. We're essentially talking about, hey, God's great strategy for redeeming your block in your neighborhood, God's great strategy for seeing your neighbors come to know Jesus, as a husband and a wife, faithfully obeying Jesus in the difficult, often painful, often disappointing, always, almost always frustrating in terms of your hopes going into it, realities of a husband and a wife loving one another, laying down their lives for one another, and fulfilling their particular vocations in the context of marriage. We'll get into kids next week, but that's what is the fruit of that covenant obedience. Generally, is sons and daughters who through their parents see and understand what God is like, through the sovereign work of God's grace, come to trust him and love him, and then are sent out into the world to do the same thing over and over and over again. So as we talk about marriage, we're not just talking about kind of one odd nook or cranny. We're actually talking about what does it mean to follow and love and obey and worship God. The way that gets worked out primarily is not really through private piety. It's through the relationship of a husband and wife. It's through the relationship of two human beings trying to navigate, how do I honor God in the way that I relate to this other person? That was honestly the thing that stood out to me in the Ten Commandments. All these grand themes about receiving God's rest, about worshiping God and God alone, of not worshiping him vainly, of not kind of transforming or altering what he's like. When it gets down to the nitty-gritty of what it actually looks like to worship God, the first place he goes is the most difficult relationship imaginable between sons and daughters and their parents. So the whole concept of worshiping God, following God, seeing the world transformed, in the end, I can talk all day about that. I love to talk about that. I love to go to all the places in Scripture where we see that. But in the end, for us as a church to be drawn up into that, at the end of the day, it just means like we have healthy relationships, we obey God. We obey God together in the context of those relationships, and particularly in the context of marriage between a husband and wife. So, with that kind of established, what is a marriage? And so, we're going to answer the question first, what is a marriage, and what do we do with it, before we start talking 37 is going to be tight. All right, so if you have a Bible, we're going to read Ephesians chapter 5, starting in verse 22. We're going to answer the question first, what is a marriage? Okay, so I want you to look particularly at verse 31. Verse 31 is actually quoting the original text that describes and defines marriage for us from Genesis. And it says in verse 31, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So what is a marriage? A marriage is a husband leaving his mother and father, coming out from under their covenantal care and being united to a woman, and that them in that covenant union being brought together as one, as a new entity, different from the mother and fathers that went before, now joined together in covenant. The best way I know to describe what covenant is by differentiating it from contract. A contract is, I want to buy a Toyota 4Runner, and so we draw up a contract with the Toyota dealership, and in that contract, they bring something to the table, a particular 4Runner, we'll make it a nice one, 2018 TRD, XRD, whatever the cool ones are, 4Runner, and it's going to be gray because gray is cool, and so they're going to bring that to the table. That's their part of the contract, and then my part of the contract is I'm going to bring a particular sum of money, probably an excessive sum of money, and then we're going to come together and we're going to exchange those, and that is a contract that binds us together around the terms of the contract. And so they bring the car, I bring the money. Now, let's say I bring $10,000 less than was agreed upon in the contract. Well, we no longer have a valid contract, right? Because in a contract, I contribute something, they contribute something, and in our mutual contributions to one another, we receive, we kind of get what we want out of the deal. I would say that most people, particularly in America and in the West, approach marriage that way. I'm coming, and they do it in a really unspoken way. I'm coming to this marriage because I want X, Y, and Z from this marriage. I want to feel a certain way. I want kids. I want maybe some financial stability. I want companionship. Pick whatever the thing is. Many of them, most of them even, really good things. I come with my list, you come with your list, and we negotiate a contract, and then we stand before our friends and neighbors and formalize that contract in front of those friends and neighbors and family members. And then at the end of that, one of the things that you find is because it was established as a contract, every few years you have to renegotiate the contract. Because usually you establish a contract because I enjoyed, was currently enjoying, will hope to in the future enjoy a particular kind of feeling or affirmation that I get from you. One of the most interesting things is you'll find is that feeling disappears quickly. Maybe not quickly in my case. That feeling still burns strong. But for most of you, probably, it burns up really fast. And so then what you have to do is you have to figure out, hey, let's renegotiate the contract. And so now and often in unspoken ways, sometimes in really spoken ways, the contract becomes, we don't have that feeling anymore, we should get a dog. And so now the contract is we're going to join together to raise this dog, and then the dog is always a precursor to children, and so then the children becomes the basis of that contract. And then one of the things that you find, I don't know how many of you that this happens to be your story, I find it to be an inordinate amount of stories, is that suddenly the kids go off to college and there's no other way to renegotiate, and marriages end in divorce. It's always stunned me. How many marriages that go for 20, 25 years and then end in divorce at that point, around the times the kids go off to college or graduate from college? And the reason why is because for 25 years they've been renegotiating a contract because that's what they understood marriage to be. That's not the way the Bible defines marriage. That marriage is covenantal. And even the language that the Bible uses to define and describe marriage is language that is all-encompassing. It's not I bring X to this marriage and you bring Y, and so long as we're both bringing that to bear, we'll get along and this thing will work. But marriage is you come to an altar and the old version of you dies, and now you've been joined together with another person in permanency. That I belong to you and you belong to me, and the whole very nature of our lives, the very nature of our identities have been utterly and completely redefined. That's what marriage is. That's what a covenant is. And that is terrifying. When Jenny and I get the, and really the joy of getting to do premarital counseling with couples, we spend a lot of our first session with them after we hear their stories, after we figure out how they met, how they decided to get married. A lot of that time is spent saying, hey, here's the promises. Here's what's actually happening to you on your wedding day. You're going to an altar to die. That's what happens at altars, by the way. I don't know if you know that. We've turned them into places where you kneel, or in the Lutheran church, they have these flip-up things, and you can, or Methodist church, I guess, flip-up things, and you can kneel down and take communion. But in real altars, you go and you sacrifice something. Something gets its throat slit. And that's what happened on your wedding day. And here's the beautiful thing about the way the Bible works. I don't care if you knew that or not. That's what you did. You can go, well, that's not what I agreed to. That's not really what I was thinking at the time. The definition of marriage is established by God. It's not established by you. It's not established by me. It's established by God, and he's defined it in terms of covenant. He's defined it in terms of these life-altering, life-redefining vows in which you've taken on a new identity. You've left mother and father, your old covenant identity, your old name, and you've been joined with a new person in a new covenant family, establishing something new, foundationally new. That's what marriage is. That's why we should approach weddings in the most celebratory and grave ways possible. And if you don't understand what that means and why you can do both, I don't know if you've understood marriage. You're coming to watch two people die and be raised from the dead. That's what happens at a wedding every single time, which is why it's perfectly, perfectly normal to sing, to dance, drink wine, to have a festival, celebrating the goodness of God as he kills these two people and raises them as something new. So that's what marriage is. Now, within the context of that, Paul in this text lays out two different vocations within that framework, two different ways in which we follow through in our obedience to God, in honoring what God has established in a marriage. And you'll find, if you want to, you can find probably endless theologians who will explain away the details of these verses. But I would just tell you, don't trust people who explain parts of the Bible away. They're placed here for a reason. They're placed here to define the nature in which, what does it look like for a wife to obey God, to honor God, to glorify God, to live in the light of everything that's come before in Ephesians? How then do I live in the light of that within the context of this covenant relationship? And it's the same thing for a husband. Now, in the light of all that God has done for you in chapters 1, 2, and 3, in the light of his enormous, sovereign, glorious grace poured out in your life, now, in the context of this covenant relationship, how do I obey him? How do I love him? And this is where the text gets very, very explicit. And he says, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is, now I want to draw attention to that verb. What's the verb? I love grammar. Is, it's a be verb, right? It is not an imperative. Except, do you guys know an imperative? So if I said, Chris, do 10 push-ups, that would be an imperative for him to do 10 push-ups, which he could kill and do 50. and he would do it to taunt me. But if I say Chris is strong enough to do push-ups, I'm not commanding him to do anything. I'm not giving him an imperative. I'm just stating a fact. I'm describing the nature of reality. And so one of the ways that Ephesians 5 and these particular roles that are played out are misunderstood is we read them in the imperative, and they're not in the imperative. He starts with a be verb with regards to the husbands. He says, for, why should wives submit to their own husbands? We're going to get to the meaning of submit. I mean, how it connects with this idea of honor or respect at the end of the chapter in a minute. He says, because, verse 23, because the husband is, this is the description of reality. This is a description of every marriage ever that's ever existed, no matter what they confessed or believed or what books they read or what they thought they were doing. This is a universal description of every marriage to the offense of every feminist on earth. So we'll just live with that. But here's what it says. The husband is the head of the wife, even as, or in the same way as, Christ is the head of the church. So what's Paul saying there? He's saying that to be a husband is to function as Christ in the context of the covenant relationship of marriage. Always. Which means the question is not, will you be the head of your home? Will you be the head of your family? Will you be the head of your marriage? Will you be covenantally responsible? Which is what I think head means. It means that you bear responsibility, leadership, self-sacrificing leadership and responsibility for your marriage. The question is not, will you do that or not? That's not the question. The question is, are you doing that well or not? Are you doing that faithfully or not? Are you doing that in a way that lies about Jesus or in a way that tells the truth about Jesus? Which is why every husband on earth should be terrified. Because what this text says is not, hey, you should be like Jesus. And if you can really be like Jesus, you can do a great job and be a good husband. No, what it says is, no matter what you do, you are always talking about Jesus. And you're either lying about Jesus or you're telling the truth about Jesus. But your role is in the context of the covenant of marriage, you represent Jesus 100% of the time, and you either do so as a liar or you do so as a faithful proclaimer of the gospel. Get it? That's what marriage is. That's what it is to be a husband. And so you can either do that in a way that is constantly lying, blaspheming about the nature and the character of Jesus, or you can do that as someone who faithfully represents the character, the grace, the mercy, the goodness, the wisdom of Jesus. In other words, this text isn't commanding you to take a certain role. It's saying you already have it. And you can either do that well and faithfully, or you can do that really, really poorly. And men have been doing it poorly for a really long time. Yesterday in our text, we were talking through the fifth commandment. And one of the kind of the foundational pieces that the fifth commandment assumes is that God has structured the world such that there is layers of authority in it. Now, so many people have abused the places of authority they've been in that the world kicks against authority. We live in a day and age in which authority is hated, despised. And it's despised because authority is often abused. In other words, people who are in places of authority, mothers and fathers over their children, husbands in the context of marriage with their wives, often lie about the very person they're supposed to represent, namely Jesus. But definitionally, what marriage is a covenant union between a man and a woman, where the man takes the role of Jesus with sacrificial responsibility, self-sacrificial leadership. We see here that Paul says that headship, that responsibility to lead his family, the goal is that your wife would flourish, would be washed with the water of the word, cleansed, made whole, nourished, that her health and her beauty would increase over the course of her lives, that her love for Jesus would increase and grow, that her feeling of being safe and cared for and delighted in, that her gifts would flourish in the light of your leadership of your home, not despite it. And this is what it means to be a husband. How does Christ lead the church? He lays down his life and dies for her. He spends his life and every ounce of his authority for her good, for her flourishing, for her life, leading her to know and delight in the Father, leading her to hate sin and to love what is good. This is why you've been given authority in your home. This is why God has structured marriage the way he has. This is your calling. And you will either do it faithfully or do it poorly. Now, wives, he defines this in terms of submission, and then also at the end of verse 33 in terms of respect, or another way to translate that is honor. And we touched on this yesterday a little bit as we talked about children honoring their parents. And one of the points I wanted to make in that context was that it does not honor the authority of your parents that when they are disobedient to God, you Just keep your mouth shut and you keep your head down. And you, in other words, the honor that honors authority that's over you, it isn't simply kind of a quietistic, keep your head down, just get walked all over like a floor mat. The kind of honor is an honor that honors and respects the role that's been given to that place of authority. It delights in the authority that's been given. It seeks to help that person in authority to serve and to lead in the context they're in. Yes, it submits and obeys, particularly when it's difficult and there's disagreement and it's not clear. This isn't a matter of disobeying God or not obeying God or not obeying God. It's a matter of maybe preference. You submit to, you obey, you honor the role that's been given. But it's not a quietistic role. It's not a just keep your mouth shut kind of role. Submission and honor is a posture of the life that says, I acknowledge, I honor, I respect, I delight in the fact that God has given you responsibility for our home to lead us to him. And I'll do everything in my power to assist you, to care for you, to respect the role that you've been given in leading our family. And it plays that part. And this together is what frames and defines a marriage. I think Paul begins here with the imperative to the wife, whereas it's just an indicative for the husband, with submit, because he's essentially saying, look, here's how the world is. Here's how God has defined and created marriage. And you can either spend your life kicking against that structure, or you can submit to. You can recognize and acknowledge that structure. And his call is to acknowledge it, to recognize it, and then to honor it. And so this is how, in the context of the covenant of marriage, we play the particular vocations that God's called us to play in the course of our lives. Now, in the 5.5 minutes that do not remain, as we've gone way over, I'm sorry, on my part, I want to talk about how does this actually then happen? If this is what a marriage is, that's what was established as you stood at an altar or in a garden somewhere, or in front of a mountain somewhere, or we did a wedding at Disney World one time, at Disney World. How does this actually happen? So it happens much like the gospel, and I think this is one of the reasons why Paul's in Ephesians 5 is saying, look, this marriage is meant to be a demonstration to the world, to your children, to one another, an experience of the gospel itself, Christ's love for the church. That's what the marriage is meant to be, a covenantal picture of Jesus and the church. And I think there's a lot of parallels that kind of fly out of it. And one of the parallels is that your marriage is established in a moment. And in the same way, you have faith, you were born again, you were raised from the dead and justified by faith freely. You are a child of God in that moment, and you will spend the rest of your lives, indeed in some extent, the rest of eternity, growing into the fullness of what does it mean to be a child of God, right? Like you're baptized into the name of Jesus. You have faith in the name of Jesus. You are declared to be a child of God, justified freely by his grace through faith. And then the rest of your life, he will strain and work with great discipline to grow into that identity. And I think marriage works the exact same way. In a moment, you are declared. I present to you husband and wife. My joy to introduce to you Mr. and Mrs. Bride. And so that becomes this declarative statement. From that moment forward, you are married, you're united, you're one. And then you will spend the rest of your life trying to work out or to cultivate cultivate the reality that you've declared or had declared to your friends and family. One way to think about it is if you're going to grow a garden, Jenny's parents have pretty remarkable garden. I would almost call it a farm. And when they went to establish this farm, they tilled the earth, they put up fences to kind of mark out this land over against the rest of the land. But there was no fruit there yet. There was no giant zucchinis, which, let's be honest, like, what do you do with a zucchini? And why do people grow so many of them? Other than zucchini bread, which is like dessert. Which is great. But anyway, but when they first established it, all they had was like a really nice fence and pretty fence. And a lot of people have pretty weddings and really beautiful weddings, or some people have less pretty weddings, whatever. But they have established the fence. This is what this land is. This is the garden. And then in the garden, they don't have any fruit. There's nothing to show for it yet, except for tilled up mud, dirt. Well, now if you go and you check out the garden, you have a nice fence. You have a nice sign that says garden. And then you have giant zucchinis, which no one knows what to do with. And you have tomatoes, which are less giant. They're kind of struggling with the tomatoes. And then you have cucumbers, which are growing well. And you have heads of kale. Is it heads of kale? Bushels of kale. Nasty, defiling leaves of kale that are bitter, whatever the thing is. And so you have that all over the garden. In other words, it took a while, but they've cultivated a garden that's now bearing fruit. Marriage works the exactly same way. Only here's the thing. They actually have to work in the garden weekly, if not daily, for those things to grow. In other words, we can have a grand, sweeping, accurate, faithful theology of marriage, and if at the end of the day it doesn't actually work itself out into pulling weeds and figuring out how to cultivate intimacy and figuring out how to even stinking communicate, those of you who are just newly married, and maybe you've already hit it, but you're going to find quickly that you keep hitting the same wall. Like, we talk about anything, but we start talking about this, and it's like we can't even talk to each other. Or this thing triggers an inability to even communicate. But when anything else under the sun, no matter how hard it is, we've been able to talk. None of those things are overcome except through a daily discipline of cultivating different kinds of practices, different kinds of virtues in us, that the only way they grow is by learning what it means to week after week and month after month and year after year to do the same intentional thing over and over and over and over again. And we break up into groups here in a few minutes. What we're going to spend a big chunk of our time doing is like trying to discover those things from one another. What are the disciplines you found that have actually cultivated the kind of virtue in marriage that seems to be growing and bearing fruit? And so I want you to be thinking about that. Don't you have to listen to what else I'm going to say. Just be thinking about that as you talk about those. How do you cultivate, I'm going to use that word really intentionally, cultivate a prayer life together? Honestly, that's like the hardest thing in the world. And it feels silly to say that, but I actually think praying together, it's still hard. It feels awkward. How do you cultivate intimacy? Physical intimacy, but also emotional intimacy. How do you know that, like, when your husband says something or your wife says something, how do you know that, like, in that moment, when they said something that would normally, maybe for reasons that wouldn't be clear to everyone else in the room, it feels really hurtful? How do you know when it's not? How do you know when to respond to those statements or those awkward, difficult moments? What kind of practices are you putting in place that you guys don't just fly off the handle at one another? A faithful, God-glorifying, joy-filled, intimate marriage is something that's grown. No one has it right off the bat. No one has just handed it. Like, I think one of the most helpful things that was said to me early on in our marriage from someone, as I'm kind of explaining how hard it feels at times, is like, it's supposed to be hard. Like, God designed it to be hard. You guys don't like to hear that, right? Just to let you know a little secret that's all over the Bible. God doesn't really design anything to be easy. Like, he wants to wreck you with everything. So he holds out this beautiful gift called marriage, which truly is a beautiful gift, and hiding behind it is a baseball bat. A really happy, joyful baseball bat, but it's a baseball bat. a baseball bat meant for your good, but it's hard. So how do you like lean into that hard? How do you begin to build repeated practices over and over and over again where you intentionally try to grow something in the garden of marriage? Where husbands, you grow from kind of this despotic leader thinking that your headship means you can do whatever you want, to kind of Christ-like, selfless leadership. someone's calling me. But wives, how do you, or maybe husbands again, how do you grow into this kind of Christ-like leadership rather than an abdicating husband who doesn't take responsibility for the direction of your family or the state of your marriage? Which, by the way, I find that the second one happens way more than the first one. Husbands, your primary, I believe the primary, particularly in our culture, in our day, in our time, your primary temptation will not be to be overbearing as a leader. It will be to utterly abdicate your responsibility in your home. And you'll call it by all kinds of different, I'll just keep going with that because I just want to hammer the guys for a second because I need to get hammered with it. I needed to get hammered with it. You'll call it deference. You'll call it kind of all kinds of different words, but in the end, you're just abdicating. You're just lazy or scared. Love you guys. Wives, the only way that happens is practice. Building practices that lead you into becoming that kind of man or that kind of woman. Second thing and last thing I'll mention, and then we'll spend the last 30 minutes talking about it, is I think that like there is, in the work of gardening, there's the kind of daily cultivating work, right? The pulling up weeds, the watering the garden, kind of make, I've never grown a garden, but I can imagine that it involves lots of daily tasks. You can imagine, I'm sure. Getting rid of bugs and foxes, to quote Solomon. So you do that kind of work. On the other side is like these, every year I remember my family would go up to Missouri. I don't know what it's called when it's your cousin who's like a third cousin or a second, whatever the thing is, where they're like older than you and they're like an uncle, but they're really a cousin. I don't know how that works and who's who, but he owned a pretty giant farm in up kind of northwest Missouri. And we'd go up for the harvest every year. And at the harvest, it was a blast. I mean, I'd ride in the combine and we would do all the things with the corn and the beans and then every night there'd be a big, all the combines would come together in one of the fields and trucks would be out there and there'd be food and a big feast and no beer at the time, but there was beer and there. It was just a big festival. It was kind of a fun celebration every night that whole week as they brought in all the crops from the different fields and then would come together every night to celebrate. And every year, we didn't go up for this part, but every year they had a planting season where this is the time that we plant this field. And there was a whole process to do that. In other words, there was these markers that were kind of beyond the day-to-day or week-to-week work that was required to cultivate and grow these crops. There was also these kind of markers that would happen throughout the year that there was the big ones were the planting season and then the harvest where it was time, now is the time to go out and fix this or make this happen. And I've found in our own marriage that the day-to-day and the week-to-week stuff it's harder to kind of figure that out, but when it happens, doing it has been great. But God has also used these kind of moments, these kind of realizations, these places in our marriage where it was a harvest season. It was a marker in our marriage where things got redefined. One example, over the last 3 years, we've had kind of an interesting journey around vocation and job and churches and one of the things that God used kind of the last 3 years to do to kind of drag out for us is that, that there were these places where Jenny and I, whenever we would kind of encounter similar kinds of circumstances, we didn't know how to talk or communicate. It would either turn into a kind of an irrational argument that never kind of settled, or we would just kind of withdraw from one another and not talk about it. It was there as a pattern over the whole course of our marriage. And one of the things that God's done over particularly probably 3 years ago, 2 years ago, is used kind of different pastors in our life to care for us, to kind of expose in really gentle ways, like, hey, you know that's because, like, there are things in you that respond to these set of circumstances the same way over and over and over again. A phrase that has been used for us is habitual disobediences, like places where you know that you're called to respond to a certain set of situation, a certain set of circumstances in a way that honors Jesus, in a way that's either submissive and honoring or a way that actually leads like Jesus, and instead both of you are disobeying these commands, and it's like the wheels come off and you just are no longer interacting in a way that accords with what a godly marriage looks like. And then digging into, oh, like, here's why. Like, there's this feelings I have that are tied to experiences I've had that are tied to deep places of fear and distrust in the sovereignty of God that lead me in those particular set of circumstances to sin over and over and over and over and over again. And yes, those weekly kind of practices have helped to fight against those things, but at the end of the day, we needed help kind of uncovering those things, seeing them for what they were, and building new habits that have helped us to learn how to, like, oh, when we encounter this situation, of course I feel like this. I always feel like this, but I'm going to behave differently than I've behaved in the past. And I've seen those in our marriage as kind of like these kind of planting moments, these places that, like, we needed help seeing it. And sometimes that's counseling. Sometimes that's a really powerful sermon. Sometimes it's just a relationship with another couple as you watch them kind of walk through something. So I want you to be thinking about that kind of framework as well. And so the two things that we're going to talk about in the 25 minutes that remain, I was really close to 37 minutes. Not really close at all. Is the first question I want you to talk about in these kind of awkward groups, kind of pull together and talk about it, is what are the rhythms, the practices, the liturgies, if you will, that you've implemented in your life, maybe on purpose because of a crisis, maybe just like this is what you decided to do as a family, and you're not even sure why, that you found have borne fruit in your marriage. Talk about those. Where did they come from? Why are they there? I mean, let me just encourage you that there are people sitting around you that need the wisdom that God's given you over the last however long, how many years you've been married. And then secondly, what have been some, like, planting moments for you? And so maybe you can share one or the other, and if you still have more time after everybody who's wanted to share has shared, you can share the other one or share more of them. I think what would be most helpful and to me is I love to hear ideas of, like, what are practices that you do? People have date nights, right? Well, what do you do on your date night? How do you not make your date night just a, where do you want to eat? I don't know, where do you want to eat? I don't know, where do you want to eat? How do you actually see a date night that bears fruit? It's actually fruitful for your relationship or for your marriage. I'd love to know, like, if any of you have, like, nailed prayer as a couple, what do you do? How did you nail that? I'd love to know. Because we still wrestle with trying to figure out how do we pray together and not feel awkward. We do it, but it's always awkward. So if anybody's nailed that, please talk to me. And so that's what we're going to do. So the first question is, what are practices you've put in place, disciplines you've put in place as a couple that have borne fruit in your marriage? And then secondly, what are big markers? What is a big marker for you that particularly if they're reproducible. You felt stuck around some issue, and then God kind of broke in, or you got counseling, or you got help, or you met this couple and talked about it, that God kind of used to kind of get you unstuck.